Okay, we're beginning on the top of Kuf Yud Tet Amud Aleph by the two dots. The Mishnah told us that individuals who are engaged in a job that does not entitle them to produce or portions of whatever they are working with, then you're not allowed to buy from those individuals. For instance, Shomrei Peirot, people who are guarding the orchards, they don't have rights to the fruit or to the branches of the tree. If they're selling those items, you can assume that they are stolen items because their job description does not involve their ownership of those items. Rav Zavin, Shvishta Me'arisa. So here the Girsa that we have is Rav. It's unlikely that the Girsa is correct that it's Rav. It's more likely that it is Rova because Abaye is about to ask him a question. So it's either got to be Rova or Rabba that is subject of this story because otherwise Abaye would not be speaking to Rav. And what happened here was that he purchased a shabishta, which Rashi says chavileh murot, which was a bundle of twigs or kindling from a sharecropper. Our Mishnah, v'lo mishomrei peirot, etzimu peirot. From those that guard the orchards, you're not allowed to buy wood, twigs, or fruit. So why are you buying this from the sharecropper that's working the field? That's talking about a shomer who has no rights in the land or in the produce at all. Aval aris, de'itlei b'gavei. On the other hand, the aris, who has real ownership in the field, emim d'nafshe kamizavin. Meaning a sharecropper owns 30% of the output of the field, so he could be selling his output when it comes to the items that he's selling outside the field. So you don't have to assume that he stole it from the balabayit. Very well, maybe his own stuff. So therefore, if to buy it from an aris, the sharecropper is fine, whereas to buy it from a shomer is much more problematic because the shomer has no rights in the produce or in the field itself. Tarabanan, shomrei peirot lochim mehen kishen yoshvin u'mochrin. You can buy from those people that are guarding the orchards when they're sitting outside the orchard and selling it. Vasalim lifnehem, and they have baskets of fruits offered in front of them. Veturtani lifnehem, and there's a big scale there that's sitting in front of them. Because it's so obvious, it's so explicit that he is selling the items over here. There's no question that he's trying to hide it from the balabayit. If he's doing it in such an exposed manner, it's clear that he has permission to do this or that he owns the items. He wouldn't do that if he was stealing it. You always, when you're stealing it, you try to do it in a method that hides it from the balim. The fact that he's doing it in such a... right, open and exposed manner shows you that he clearly is not stealing the item. B'chulan shamru hatmein asur. If he tells you, you know, put it away, don't let anybody see this, it's clear here that he's selling hot merchandise, he's selling things that are stolen, and therefore, no matter what the circumstances or context is, then you don't buy it from them, because anybody who's telling you to hide the item is telling you that also that it was a stolen item. Lochimihem mipetach hagina. You can buy from them by the main entrance to the garden or to the orchard, but not from the back entrance. Again, if he's selling in the front entrance, he's not afraid of being caught. He's not afraid of the balabayit seeing him. That means that what he's doing is legal or he's not taking stolen goods. If he's trying to sell it to you from the back door or some hidden way or underhanded manner, it's clear there that he's also trying to sell stolen merchandise.
Sell off the truck.
He's selling you the stolen merchandise at the back door, so that you don't want to be purchasing. So again, no matter what the you have to look at the context or the circumstances to understand whether the person is selling items that are he's entitled to sell, or whether these are items that are stolen. Itmar, gazlan me'imat mutar liknot emenu. At what point is it mutar to buy from a gazlan? Now, the formulation of the question can be in one of two ways. It can either be a person who is known to be a gazlan, and you know that he has stolen merchandise. When can you buy from him and assume that he no longer has that stolen merchandise? What you're buying is not the stolen merchandise. Or it could be a gazlan that did tshuva. And now that he did tshuva, you want to buy from him, but he has stolen merchandise, and you want to only buy the stuff that is mutar. At what point has he worked through the stolen merchandise? It's a similar question that comes up with regards to chametz shavala v'pesach. An individual didn't sell their chametz on Pesach, a store that didn't sell their chametz on Pesach. Now you have chametz shavala v'pesach. When has that run out? When can you start buying from the store and assume that it's not chametz shavala v'pesach? Similar conceptually to this idea of when you're buying, when can you assume that you're getting mutar stuff? Rav Amar Sheit Rov Mishelo. It's pretty easy. Rav just says it's based on the Rov. When the majority of what he's selling is not gezel, then you can buy it, because then, a la rov, you can assume that you're not getting the gezel in that situation. The Shmuel's answer, which is the way we paskin, Shmuel amar afilu mi'ut shelo. Shmuel says, even if the minority is his, and the majority of what he has is stolen items, you can still buy from him. Now that's a little strange, because why would you assume then, if you're buying from him and the majority is stolen items, that you're not getting the majority? The answer is that it's a safek to start with. So you're dealing with a safek, and all we need is a tliyah leheter. We just need something that we can hang our hat on and say that what you're buying is the heter stuff. So as long as he has sufficient of a miut, a minimum amount of stuff that is heter, then because it's a safek, we can make the assumption that what you're getting is the heter stuff. Now that would mean if you buy all of his merchandise, or you buy more than the amount of heter that he has there, that this wouldn't work. Then it's clear that you're taking problematic stuff. So it has to be that the mi'ut is sufficiently large enough that you're buying less than that, and therefore you can assume that what you're getting is the heter stuff. And again, because it's all premised on this idea that there's a safek here. We don't know what he has. And because there's a safek, we give the benefit of the doubt and assume that you got the stuff that is heter. Orile Rav Yehuda la'ada dailo. So Rav Yehuda is both a Talmid of Rav and Shmuel. So he paskin, or he instructed, Ada was the name of the individual, Daila is the person who serviced the Chachamim, who was a shamash of the Chachamim. Kedivei Omer, afilu miyut shalo. Like the one who says that miyut shalo, which is the Shmuel. Given the psak halachot, Ada Daila, he paskin like Shmuel. Mamon masur, money or the possessions of a moser. Now we dealt with a moser until now, which is that one is not allowed to turn over money of Jews to the authorities. When they are forced or compelled, that's not the case. But in a situation where they voluntarily offer or direct the authorities to someone else's property, then they are held responsible for that, and they're known as a moser. So now, with regards to his possessions, what is the din? Rav Huna of Rav Yehuda, machloke between Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda. Chad amar mutar la'abdo biyad. One of them says you can destroy his property actively. You can take his property without any worries. Chad amar asur la'abdo biyad. The other one says you can't actively do this. You can't destroy his property. You can't take from him. What's the reasoning? Mad amar mutar la'abdo biyad. The one who says that you can take his property freely or destroy it freely. Lo ye mimono chamor migufo. Why should his money be any better than he himself? And with regards to he himself, we know that the Mishnah in the second paragraph of Avodah Zarah says that when it comes to haminim v'maserot, hamoserot, moridin otan labor v'lo malin. You can throw them into a pit and you don't have to take them out. Meaning that they are deserving of the death penalty. And you can, quote unquote, kill them. You don't actively kill them. You throw them into a pit and then they die themselves in the pit. But the fact that you can do that to him, if his life is hefker, then certainly his money should be hefker. So that's the reasoning behind that, Manda Amar. Again, as I mentioned yesterday, even though the Bati Dinim over the centuries, over the millennia, did not adjudicate capital cases, the one exception to that rule is this issue of Moser. That they saw Moser as being something so dangerous for the Jewish community that they did subject the Mosrim to the death penalty. And Bate Dinim did go after Mosrim because of the fact that once they gave the authorities reason to come after the Jewish community, it was a downward spiral. And it ended up, or terribly for these Jewish communities, or it was really opening up Pandora's box, and therefore they needed to nip it in the bud. And again, I spoke yesterday about the fact that it's sometimes misused with regards to people who turn over real criminals or sexual offenders to the authorities. That's not a moser. That's someone who's protecting the community and doing the right thing. But anyway, this is echoes of that idea that the moser is deserving of the death penalty. And if that's the case, his money should be no better than his goof. Manda Meir, the one who says it's a sur, labdo, that you can't destroy it actively, dilma avale zaram alya. Very interesting idea that maybe you will have children who follow in the Derech Hashem and who do not act in this way, who do not behave this way. V'chtiv, and the Pasuk says in Iyov, yachin v'tzadik yobash, that one prepares and the tzadik will wear it. Now the word rasha does not appear in the Pasuk, but it is the implied subject of the Pasuk in Iyov, Therefore, the Gemara adds in the word Rasha, which is Yachin Rasha, but Tzaddik Yilbash. Meaning that the Rasha prepares, he does all the work, and then in the end, the Tzaddik will wear the production or the output of this Rasha. And similarly, if you have this Moser who is a Rasha, he might have children who are Tzaddikim, good people, and they will be the beneficiaries of all his money or his possessions, and therefore we don't want to take away his possessions because it doesn't just affect him, it affects the next generation. The same is true with regards to Yerusha, which the Gemara speaks about in other places, that even though if you have two children and one child is following the Derech Hashem, the other one is a Rasha, in terms of Yerusha, we don't necessarily favor the one who is a Tzaddik or following the Derech Hashem for this similar type of reasoning, which is that you never know that the child that is off the derech or is a Rasha right now, you have no idea where his children will end up, and therefore withholding the Yerusha from him is also withholding it from his children or the grandchildren who might in the end be beneficiaries and deserving beneficiaries of the Yerusha, a similar concept that is being exposed over here. We paskin that you're not allowed to go after it actively after his property. That's the Gemara here is not speaking about ill-gotten property, meaning that they're speaking about the Moser who's turning over other people and he has his possessions. They're not saying here that he got the ill-gotten gains from the fact that he turned over other people, that he was a Moser. That might be a different din, meaning that the Gemara here is only addressing his personal property when he is a Moser. What's the story? It's not saying if then through being a Moser, he's the beneficiary of that, then what do? That the Gemara here is not addressing. Okay, Rav Chista, Havalei Hawarisa. Rav Chista had this sharecropper. Dava Tokyo V'yohiv, Tokyo V'shakil. He used to weigh it and give it to him. He used to weigh it and take it. So now, the way Rashi explains this, he brings two interpretations of possibilities. One was that he was very medactic, that he would give exactly the right amount to Rav Chista and kept the exact amount for himself. He wasn't mochel at all. He didn't have what we would call this innate or inherent generosity to him, where he's mochel on little things. Instead, he was so exacting about what the split was between him and Rav Chista. The other way Rashi describes it is that he, one for me, one for you. He waited and took, he waited and he gave. So I like the same concept of 50-50. I get 50%, you get 50%. I take one, you get one. Now, an aris, a sharecropper, generally takes about 30% of the crop. That was the standard payment to a sharecropper. This sharecropper was either greedy or he was stealing from Rav Chista and he was taking 50% of the output and not 30% of the output. The Marshal brings a third possibility, which is that Havatokyo V'yohiv, Tokyo V'shokyo is what's said in the end of Parshat Kitetze, that you shouldn't be b'mido b'mido, that you shouldn't be selling and buying with different weights, because that's cheating. And he was doing the same thing over here. When he was measuring what he got, he used one weight. When he was measuring what Rav Chista got, he used a different weight. And so therefore he was cheating him in that case. Salkei, he removed him, he fired him. Kara Nafshe, Rav Chista said about himself, B'tzafun l'tzadik chel chuteh, that what is kept hidden or as a present for the tzaddik is the work of the sinner. So over here, the sharecropper was acting inappropriately, stealing from Rav Chista, so he fires him. So in the end, the work of the sharecropper came back to Rav Chista because he got rid of him, and then either he got the produce back or he didn't have to pay him out because he was stealing, or the fact that he worked the land for the period of time that he was there, he was still able to benefit from that work, even though you had to fire him in the end. Now, the Gemara continues with a different pasuk, and which is going to lead us into a discussion about the theft and looking at a person who steals. Ki matikvat chanif, what is the hope for someone who is a hypocrite? Ki yivtza, when he profits, or botse or batza is really mostly theft, he profits from theft. Ki yeshel eluka nafsho, that a Kodesh Baruch Hu will cast away, slip away his nefesh, his soul. So what is the meaning of this pasuk? Ravuna, Rav Chista. We have a machloket here to Rav Chuna and Rav Chista explaining this pasuk. Chadamar nafsho denigzau. It's speaking about the nefesh of the one who is the victim of the theft, which is, what is the hope for someone who's a hypocrite when he steals? Ki yesh, Because in the end, he's going to end up that Hashem is going to have his soul, meaning that the one who was stolen from the victim is going to pass away, and his soul will return to God. It means that God will slip away the nefesh of the thief, because the one who stole now is subject to, quote-unquote, a death penalty. The one who says that it's the nefesh of the victim of the theft, because the pasuk says in Mishlei, Kain archot kol butzea butza. This is the way of all of those despoilers, all of those thieves. And nefesh balav yikach. They take the life of its owner. So what it means is that when one steals, it's not simply stealing the monetary possessions of the individual, but they also take the life of the individual. They are causing more than just monetary damage to the victim. They are, in a sense, causing them stress, but even points of losing their life in the process of stealing from them. The one who says it is the gazlan who's deserving of this death penalty, because the pasuk says in Mishlei, "Al tigzal dal ki dal hu." Do not steal from those that are impoverished because they are impoverished. That's one way to read it. Ki dal hu. Rashi, on the other hand, says ki here means despite the fact that he is impoverished. So the way Rashi reads it is, don't steal from the dal, even though he doesn't have much to steal. Don't steal from him. Or the other way to read it is, don't steal from the impoverished, ki dal hu, because he's impoverished. What you take is so significant when you take from the one who is impoverished. Ve'al tedageh ani b'shar, and do not oppress the poor in the shar. Here is probably in the batei din, where in the courts you should not oppress them, or when you go to adjudicate or decide cases. Ki Hashem yariv rivam. God will stand up for them. He will fight their battles. V'kavat kovehem nefesh. And he will steal away the soul of those that steal. Now, the word koveya or kavat, you might remember it from Malachi in Perek Gimel when we read it on Shabbat HaGadol. There it says that HaKadosh Baruch says, you ask, v'meh kavanucha, how did you guys steal from me? How can you steal from God? Right? It's impossible to steal from God. So there, the Navi explains that they were covet, they stole the Trumot and Masrot that went to the Kohanim, which is what God is given, and then that God gives over to the Kohanim. So God says, you stole from me because you didn't properly give what is deserving to others. You didn't take care of those others. So over here, what it means is, v'kavad koveen is nefesh, that you're going to steal their soul. Meaning God, mida keneged mida, this person stole from that impoverished individual and caused them death, in a sense, he will be punished with God stealing away his nefesh. The gazlan, the thief's nefesh, will be lost over here. V'idach nami aktiv nefesh balav yikach. According to this man damar, who says that the gazlan's nefesh is lost here, what does it mean, nefesh balav yikach? From the pasuk of Mishlei, it sounds like the nefesh of the owner. The owner is the victim of the theft. His nefesh will be lost. My balav, he'll explain balav, balav dehashta. Doesn't mean the original owner. It means the current owner of the item, which is the thief. Doesn't the other one who says that, we're speaking about the nefesh of the nigzal. What are you going to do with the pasuk in Mishlei that says, kavad koveim nefesh, that God's going to steal away the nefesh of the one who steals from the dal? It says, matam kamar. It's giving you the reason. Matam kavad koveim. Why is it that Hashem will steal away from them, mishum de kavai nefesh, because they stole someone's soul. I mean that the reason they're going to be held accountable over here is because they're stealing the soul of the victim. Not that their soul will be taken out, but the victim's soul that they took out, that they will be punished for. God will steal away from them. Now, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, kol haguzelet chaveiro shaveh pruta, kilu notel nishmato mimenu. So Rabbi Yochanan, in a sense, continuing along this line of thinking, says that anybody who steals from his friend, the shaveh pruta, which is the minimum amount to be considered gzela, below that amount is the mechila, kilo notel nishmato mimenu, if it takes his life away. So in this process, if you connect it back to the previous sugya that spoke about the moser, we said that the moser is considered to be like he is killing the individual. Even though he's only giving over property or the possessions of an individual to the authorities, we don't view it as just being giving over his possessions or his money to the authorities. We view it as turning in of this individual to the authorities as if he's taking his life. And here you have that description here in the Gemara that stealing from someone, taking one's possessions and considered like killing them, or you're deserving of the death penalty because you killed them. And Rabbi Yochanan also says, Kiilu notel nishmato mimenu. And therefore the moser, even though he looks like he's just a thief, in the end, he's more than just a thief, and that's why he's, in many senses, subject to the death penalty. Because he's really killing the victim of the theft over here, or he's deserving of death. Shenemar, Kain or Chot kol botzei abatza, nefesh balav yikach. He quotes the pasuk that we just quoted from before, that this is the way of all those that are thieves, despoilers. Nefesh balav yikach. They take the life of the victim, of the owner of the item that they steal. So you see that when they steal, it's as if they took their life as well. Vomer, the Gemara now will continue and bring three additional psukim to back this up, and to go back and explain why we need all four psukim. Vomer, v'chal ki yitzircha v'lach mecha, the enemy will come and eat your harvest and your bread. Yochlu banecho b'notecha, they will eat your sons and daughters. Again, we'll come back and see what the meaning of that is. Vomer, mechamas b'nei Yehuda sheshefchu dam naki, over there in Yoel, it's speaking about Mitzrayim and Edom. Mitzrayim and Edom, why will Hashem punish them or hold them accountable? Because of Mechamas Bnei Yehuda Sheshafu Dam Naki, from all the theft and the plundering they did to Bnei Yehuda, that they spilled innocent blood. Shafu Dam Naki, they spilled innocent blood in their land. Vilmer, and it says here, the fourth Pasuk, El Sha'ol Ve'Beit Adamim, to Shaul and his house of blood, Asher Yimit et Gibonim, that they killed the Gibonim. Mai ve'omer. Why do we need four psukim? V'chitema nefesh didei. You would think that when he steals from an individual, the victim, he is causing the death of the victim, figuratively. Aval nefesh benavu natav lo. But with regards to his family, he's not affecting the family. So tashma, that's what it brings. Basar benav ubnotav. It says, not only is he affecting the individual, but even his family is affected by that. And that's what's meant in the pasuk over here. V'chal ki tzercha v'lach mecha. The enemy will come and consume your production and your food. And then the pasuk continues, yochlu banechu v'notecha. Whereas the Gemara says, banechu v'notecha. Because the way the Gemara is reading it is that when the enemy comes and eats your production, it's as if they ate your children, because stealing from the individual is the equivalent of stealing not only from the individual, but from his entire family. And just like when you steal from the individual, you cause him death, so too you cause the family. Or in essence, what the person was going to give to his children, you have now taken away. So you've taken away his ability to provide for his family, and therefore, in a sense, you've caused the death of his family. And that's why the thief is also implicated here, not only about the individual, the victim, but even the family of the victim. Maybe that's only true when he didn't pay for it. But in a case where he paid for it, even though he stole it, it's chamas, which is when you pay for something and still steal it. Maybe over there he would not have the same idea behind it, which is that when you take, it's as if you killed them. Tashma, mechamas bnei Yehuda sheshefchu dam naki be'artzam. The pasuk says that Edom and Mitzrayim are implicated in the theft from Yehuda. But then when it says the theft of Yehuda, meaning Hamas, where they maybe paid for it, Asher Shafchu Dam Naki, it's considered as if they spilt innocent blood. Not because they killed them, but because they stole from them. So the theft from them is still considered as if you spilt innocent blood in the Aretz. That's why they brought the third pasuk. So now, the last pasuk is brought because you would have thought as maybe only when he's the direct cause or the direct thief in this case. Of al groma lo. If he's only a proximate cause to the theft, maybe there he wouldn't be held accountable or it wouldn't be as if he killed him. Tashma. El Sha'ul v'beit adamim asher yimita et ha-givonim. That is what Sha'ul is blamed here for the killing of the givonim. Ve'yeichan matzinu sherak Sha'ul et ha-givonim. We find nowhere that Sha'ul ever killed any of the givonim. And the pasuk is brought in Shmuel Bet after they have a famine and they need to figure out what's going on. In the end, they figure out that the Givonim were slighted by Shaul and they demand that David HaMelech give them the descendants of Shaul in order to kill them or to hang them out in the fields. And that's what they do in order to end the famine. So here the pasuk says the reason that it was is because of Beit Shaul Beit Adamim, Asher Mita Givonim, that he had killed the Givonim. And therefore, the Givonim want their quote-unquote revenge in killing the descendants of Shaul. That's how the Gemara notes in places that we know that they're not part of Bnei Yisrael, because the fact that they acted in this manner, that they wanted revenge and they wanted to kill someone for what they had done, that was an indication that they were not of Jewish nature, or they didn't have rachmanut. They had no mercy. David pleads with them not to kill them, and they refuse to accept the plea of David, the apology, or any restitution. They want to kill the descendants of Shaul. That demonstrated that these are individuals that don't have that midata rachamim, and they're clearly not Jewish. El mitoch sharag nov ira kohanim. Shaul kills out ir nov kohanim, nov ira kohanim, when Doeg Edomim speaks lashon hara about the fact that they gave sanctuary to David at the time. And Shaul, because of that, goes and kills out all the kohanim. Nov ira kohanim. Shaul maspikim lehem mayim mazon. We know from the time of Yoshua that Yeshua establishes that the Givonim, their job is going to be that they have to provide wood and water for Bnei Yisrael, for the Mikdash. So they worked where the Kohanim were, by Nov. That's where the, quote-unquote, Mishkan, Mizbeach, or Aron was found at the time. Remember that it travels around because of the fact that Mishkan Shiloh was destroyed. And in an interim period, it's in Nov and Givon. At this point, it's in Nov. After Nov is wiped out, it moves over to the Givon. So Shaul goes and kills out all the Kohanim. Therefore, they lost their parnasa. He took away the Givonim's parnasa. Malei alav ha'ketuv ki lahorgan. And the pasuk attributes to Shaul as if he killed them. Even though he never killed anybody, he simply took away their parnasa. In a sense, stole their parnasa. And because of that, he's deemed as if he killed them. So you see that even when you're not the direct cause, but you're just the proximate cause, you are the grama that causes the person to lose out with their parnasa or to steal from them, then you're also held accountable and if you killed them or you took their nefesh. Okay, now, the end of the Mishnah says that with regards to certain items, you can buy them if it makes sense that these people should be selling them. But it says, lochimina nashim, you're allowed to buy from women items that we would assume that their husband gave them permission to sell, or that they normally are engaged and working on, and therefore they should be able to sell. Tan Rabbanan, we have a braita similar to our Mishnah, but more extensive. Lochimin anashim klei tzemer b'Yehuda. In Yehuda, again, we know this from the Mishnayot in Ketubot, that the woman has a requirement of producing a certain amount per week as her maisa yadayim. In Yehuda, that involved tzemer, wool, because that's what they wore and that's what they processed. And therefore, a woman who's selling klei tzemer b'Yehuda, that makes sense, because that's what she contributes towards the family. I mean, that's her masa yadayim. Klei pishtan b'galil. In the Galil, they wore linen, and therefore, what the woman produced was linen garments. Aval lo yenot ushmanim l'siltot. But you may not buy from them wine, oil, or fine flour, because there we assume that it belongs to the husband, and they're stealing from their husband to sell off and to get money. V'lo minan avadim. And you also can't buy that from the slaves of an individual. V'lo min ha'tinokot, and not from minors who are selling these items. I mean, all these people, you have to assume that they stole it from the owner, the balabait, the father, the husband, and now they're selling it to try to raise money. Because why else would they have this in their possession? Abba Sholomer, mocher tisha barba abba chamisha dinar, kde lasut kipa l'rosha. So Rabbi Shaul says that if it's an amount that adds up to 4 or 5 dinar, then that would be plausible that her husband gave her what to sell or merchandise to sell to raise that type of money, because that's the cost of a kippah. A kippah is something that we recognize from the Mishnah at the end of Gittin with regards to the requirements for a woman to cover her hair. Over there, the Gemara speaks about 2 head coverings. There is the kippah, which is the equivalent today of a really big nanachman kippah, which is it surrounded the hair that was actually attached to the head. It was like a cap, a skull cap. But literally a skull cap, a full cap around the head, where the hair on the sides and in the back would stick out, but the hair on the skull itself was covered. That was a sufficient covering for the woman inside of her chatzer or inside of her house, not in the public domain. She went out to the public domain, then she'd wear a tzaif. She'd wear some sort of turban or covering that covered the additional hair that stuck out of the kippah. But a kippah, which is a basic beged of the woman, then in all likelihood, the husband would provide her items to sell so she could raise the money to buy herself a new kippah, and therefore you could buy from her in that instance. B'kulan shamru latmin asur. Anybody who tells you to keep it under the table, hide it, again, from the context, you know that they're doing something wrong, and therefore, even if it has the other attributes here that would make it okay, if they tell you to go hide it and don't show anybody, that's already an indication that it's a stolen item and you can't purchase it. Gabay tzedaka. When it comes to the gabay tzedaka, Rashi claims that the individual, gabay tzedaka, luchime and davar muat, you're allowed to purchase small items from them, aval lo davar mubeh, but not large items. The idea being that small items is what he owns. These are his things. Therefore, he can sell off these small items and you're allowed to purchase from him. If he's selling large items or large quantities, it's more likely that it's coming out of the tzedakah that he's collecting. And now he's transacting or stealing from the tzedakah. Assume here that he's collecting a food or something for people. And now he's selling off the food in large quantities. Sounds like he made a catering business out of doing tzedakah and collecting food from people. So that's a problem. You can't do that, and therefore we won't allow you to buy from him because the context makes it questionable about what he's selling. Okay, va'badadim. Rashi claims the badadim are people who own beit habad. They own the olive presses, and people bring them olives to press into oil. Others claim the badadim are the workers who work in the olive press. In either case, they are not the owners of the olives or the oil. They're either owners of the machinery that does it, or they are the workers who do the pressing. Just as an aside, this morning in Slichot, in the second Slicha that we said this morning, it talks about Bnei Yisrael being crushed like a Beit Abad. But anyway, just topically connected. Lochim en zeitim bimida, v'shemen bimida. You are allowed to buy from them commercial quantities of olives and commercial quantities of oil. Aval lo zeitim bimuat, v'shemen bimuat. But not small quantities of oil, small quantities of olives. The assumption being that if they are selling large commercial quantities, first of all, they can't hide it. And number two is they must have permission from the owners to do this, because otherwise they wouldn't be selling these large quantities. If they're selling you small quantities, that means that they're basically slicing it off. They're skimming off of what the people are giving them, and then they're selling what they're skimming off. And that's problematic because they're not the true owners of the oil or the olives. And therefore, we're not going to assume that they have this. If they have it, they're probably taking it from someone else. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Omer, luchim inashim zeitim bimuat. You can buy small amounts or small quantities of, whether it's oil or olives, from women bigalil elyon, in the upper Galilee. Shipe'amim adam bosh limkor al petach beito. Because sometimes a person is embarrassed to sell at the entrance to his doorway. And therefore he gives it to his wife in order to sell. So now to come back to your question, Yechiel, the problem here is that generally the men were engaged in selling, merchandising, and therefore when you're talking about Yayin, Solet, and Shemin, the individual is going to be selling that is the man, because he's involved in commerce and in business. If a woman is selling that, it's suspect because she's not generally engaged in business dealings, in merchandising, in commercializing whatever they have. So because of that, we assume that if the woman is selling it, it's problematic. If the man is selling it, we assume that's his possession, his property, and he's selling it given the context that it makes sense that he would be in possession of such items. The Gemara here states an exception where a woman might be selling, which is, in the Galil Elyon, Rashi claims up there, oil was very expensive. So people would sell small quantities of oil to raise capital. But since it's below, I would say, normal commercial quantities, it would be embarrassing for the man to sell it. He's in business. For him to sell this little bit of oil or a small quantity of oil, that would be below his dignity or beneath his dignity because it looks like he doesn't have sufficient business to do. But a woman would do such a thing because, again, she's not a commercial seller. She's not a merchant. She sells household quantities, and therefore it would be considered okay. Here in the Galil Elyon, where oil is so expensive that even a small quantity will raise a decent amount of money, it might be because of that circumstance that the woman would be selling small quantities of oil. And that's an exception to the rule that women selling small quantities of oil is suspect. Over here in the Galil Elyon, it's not suspect. Again, it has to do with the mores of society, the cultural norms. All of this is not determined by quote-unquote the halacha over here, It's mostly determined by what is normal in these situations. What is the arrangements that people have? And we're going to see that more in the next Mishnah, that the arrangements between parties might determine what they're entitled to keep or not keep in certain circumstances where they work with different objects. Ravina ikla le bei mechuza. Ravina went to bei mechuza. Rashi claims that he was a gabai tzedaka that was going to there. But you could just think that it was Ravina as a Talmid Chacham was going to visit bei mechuza. Adu nishede bei mechuza. The women of bei mechuza came out to greet him. Ramu kame kablei v'sheire. They threw in front of him kablei, like cables. They threw them chains of gold. And sheire and their earrings or some sort of nose ring, they were throwing it at him. So now kablei minayu, he accepted it from them. Now if he's the gabai tzedaka, he accepted this as their gifts to tzedaka. He's not the gabai tzedaka, he was a Talmid Chacham. It was a common practice to shower the Talmid Chacham with valuables when he came to the city, when he came to visit the city. The problem is it's the women that are doing this. And how could he accept from the women? They were taking this from their husbands and giving it to him. Samalei Rabba Tosfada Ravina Vatanya Gabayt Staka Mekabli Mehem Davar Muat. By Gabayt Staka, you can only take from them small amounts of Alo Davar Mubeh, but not a lot of stuff. This is gold. This is a significant item that you're taking from these women. Now, if he's a gabai tzedaka, like Rashi says, then that's why they bring the proof from gabai tzedaka. If he's not a gabai tzedaka, then the proof is just the fact that when someone is not known to be in possession of an item, or you don't expect them in possession of an item, you can buy small quantities from them, not large quantities. The woman, we don't expect to have large quantities of these items. So if she's giving away small quantities, we assume the baal was mochel on it. But if she's given large quantities or expensive items, how do you know that she's not stealing from her husband in order to do this? B'nei Mechuza were very wealthy. And for them, this was just a de minimis pocket amount. Change. This was, right, this was pocket change for them. It wasn't something of significance. And I think that Rava was the Mora D'Atra of Mechuza. And we know that in places, Rava speaks about the fact that he had difficulty with the individuals who lived in Mechuza. They were very wealthy. They didn't necessarily listen to the Chachamim. And they had certain behaviors that were mufunakim because they were so wealthy. But that's this idea that it was a wealthy town, and here this was a davar muat for them, and that's why you can assume, or you can assume that they didn't steal from their husbands, but rather they had permission to do this. Okay, next Mishnah. The Mishnah that closes out the Masechet here speaks about different professions. What is the expectation of what the professional keeps, and what has to be returned to the balabayit? So here we have Muchin Shakuves Motzi. These shreds of wool that the launderer takes out of the beged. When he's cleaning the beged, these little tufts or shreds of wool come away. Hari elu shalo. They belong to him. He can keep them. That's the expectation in that situation. Then asurek. Then the asurek, which is the carder or the fuller, that's someone who combs, cleans, shrinks, or stretches out the wool. Motzi, whatever he takes out, I mean the wool that comes out when he's working, those belong to the balabait. The way Rashi explains it is, the difference between a koves is someone who launders, a regular laundry guy. A sorek is someone who does significant work on the beged. That means straightening it out, making it look nicer, fixing it up, all of that. So the koves is entitled to the wool because he has small quantities of wool that come away. The sorek, who, the comber, who is combing out large pieces of wool, is going to be, end up with a large amount of wool that's left over. There, the balabait is not mochel. The other way to explain this is that the koves and the sorek here are in the processing of the wool. The koves is the one who washes the wool, and the sorek is the one who combs the wool, or is the one who cards the wool. So that is a possible explanation. It's much more difficult to say that because of the next line in the Mishnah and the Gemara as well, which makes it seem like we're talking about finished products over here. Koveis notel gimel chutim vein shelo. When it comes to a beged, when they wove the bigadim, the clothing, they used to, at the edge of the clothing, they used to add in an additional three strings that weren't necessarily of the same material as the beged, and weren't necessarily the same color as the beged. It was to keep it hooked in or to keep it from falling apart. So they used to, right, stop it from fraying or a seam of some sort. The koveis, when he washes it, takes out those chutim in order to wash it properly and to pull down the strings and make it clean. Those strings he can keep because the balabait is mochel on those three strings, because in the end they don't belong to the beged. They're not part and parcel of the beged. Yeah, I don't know. It seems from here that only when it's first woven do they do this. But after it's already been worn and then laundered, the wool, I guess, tightens in place, and you don't need those strings there anymore to keep it in place or keep it from fraying. That's what it seems like from the Gemara here. Yeter mikain, if it's more than three strings, harielu shel balabait, then it belongs to the balabait because it's too much, it's too significant an amount. There it goes back to the balabait. Imaya shachor agabe lavan, if there was black wool that was on top of the white wool, notela takol, then the koveis or whoever's working with it can take everything because the black wool ruins the look of the white wool, and therefore taking it out is proper, and he can expect to keep it. And they're his. Achayat, the tailor or the stitcher, shishieret achut, kedeli torbo, he has extra thread that is left over from that which he was stitching. Umatlichi gimel gimel, or if he has a small patch that is 3 etzvot by 3 etzvot, arielu shel balabait. They belong to the balabait, meaning that the tailor doesn't get to keep that remnant of whatever he was making, or the thread that he's using, if there is a significant amount of thread, which is daily for amount enough to still stitch with it, then he can't keep it, it goes to the balabait. Masha harash motzi, a carpenter, when he is going to plane the wood to make the trees into beams or into logs into beams, then if he does it with a ma'atzad, if he's cleaning up with an edz or a plane, then areu shalo, he gets to keep that wood because those are smaller shavings of the wood when you plane the wood in that way. Ubikashil, if he uses an axe to do this, then shel balabait, because then when you chip off, when you use the axe to slice off or smooth out the item, it takes more significant slices or strips of the wood off, and that belongs to the balabait. Bimayav se itzel balabait, that's only if he is a kablan, he's a contractor working on the wood, that balabait hands him the wood and he works on it. So it's a question of those shavings, what does he get to keep? Does he get the larger ones he has to give back, the smaller ones he gets to keep? On the other hand, if he's working as a employee of the balabait in the balabait's house, afen nisarim shel balabait, likely the word nisarim is wrong here, nisoret shel balabait. Even the fine sawdust will belong to the balabait, because he's not working here as a contracted worker, he's working here as a employee of the balabait. And therefore, everything belongs to the balabait, even down to the small shavings or the sawdust, the balabait gets to keep. All right, Tanu Banan. Luchim mukrin min hakoveis. One can purchase tufts of wool or shreds of wool from a launderer. The reason being, mipnei she'ein shelo. The reason is because they're his. Meaning that the reason you can buy from him is because it's plausible that he has this stuff from his job because he's entitled to keep them in his job. A koveis notel shnei chutim ayelyonim. Koveis is allowed to take out the two upper strings, vein shelo, and they're his. Obviously, this is a problem. The Braita here says two strings. Our Mishnah says three strings. The Gemara will come back to that. Now the Braita is going to continue. Velo yatil bo yoter mishlosha chuvin or chuchin. One may not put in more than three loops in here. Rashi, the way he explains it is, in order for them to work on the beged, to bang it with the staves and to wash it properly and stretch it out, what they used to do is they put loops into the beged and then pin it out to hold it out. Those bigadim, when they pull them out with the loops, Rashi claims that you can only stitch them in with a 3-ply stitch. You can't stitch them in tighter than that, the 3-ply, because otherwise the loop will be too strong. The other side of that is, or you're limited to putting in 3 loops, meaning 3 different loops to tie it out, you can't put in more. The reason being that wherever you put the loops, first of all, it leaves a hole. Number two is it stretches the wool out in that place, which then afterwards has to be fixed and sliced off, and that leaves, again, excess wool there. That excess wool is kept by the launderer. So then it looks like he is self-dealing because he's putting extra loops in or extra things because he knows there'll be excess afterwards. So we limit the number of loops that he can do to pin out the beged in order that he doesn't, first of all, hit it too hard. He doesn't cause too much damage or end up with too much excess afterwards, which he has to cut away from the beged. So that's the description that Rashi gives and others give of what's going on over here. Below Yisroel ka beged l'shityo elo le'ervo. One may not comb the beged along the warp, But you have to do it along the woof. The warp would be the longer, probably vertical strings, let's call them. The woof would be the shorter horizontal strings. There are two reasons for that, and we'll see that in the Gemara. Just keep in mind that there is a difference between the thickness of the warp and the woof strings, that the warp strings were thinner than the woof strings that were thicker. Umishavyohu la'arko. If he wants to straighten it out, Rashi over here means that he wants to cut away from the beged. He's given the beged, and now he wants to make it straight. When it was woven, it was a little uneven, or after it was utilized, it became uneven. So now he wants to straighten it out. So when he goes to cut it, he should cut it along the lengthwise of a lola rachbo, and not along the width. Vim balash voto. And when he does that, ad tefach rashai. Up to a tefach he can cut off in order to straighten it out. I mean, that's the maximum amount he should have to cut off in order to make it straight. If he has to take more than that, then that's excessive in terms of straightening out the beged. Now the Gemara is going to go back and discuss this braita. Amar mar. So what we mentioned already, the braita says shnei chutin. Banan stan, our mister says shalosh, says three chutin. Lokasha, haba alime, abiktine. It depends on the thickness of the string that was put in there. If they are thick strings, then you're only entitled to take two off the koveis. If they are thin strings, then he's entitled to take off three strings in the bottom of the beged. Velo yisroka beged l'shityo elo l'ervo. Now that a comb it to its, on its vertical along the warp, you have to comb it along the woof. Vatanya ipcha. Don't we have a braita that says just the opposite? Lokasha, that's not a problem. Abaglima habasarvela. Difference between, Rashi says over here, a glima is more like a tunic. It's an everyday beged versus a sarvala, which is a cloak or a coat that is worn on occasion. The difference being that the glima, which is used every day, we're more focused on utility than the beauty of the item. The sarvala, which is a cloak or an overgarment, that we're more focused on the beauty than the utility. For that reason, when it comes to the combing of the item, if you comb it along the sheti, along the warp, or that's called the vertical lines, the longer lines, then you make the beged look nicer, but you also wear the beged down because the warp strings are thinner. So if you comb it, you're going to cause it to be weaker or worn down faster, and this is an item the guy wears every day. So he wants it to last as long as possible. Therefore, we give priority to combing it along the woof, because that way it will be good and long-lasting, even though it may not look as nice. On the other hand, by the sarvala, which is something that's for its beauty, over there we give priority or precedence to combing it along the warp, even though it weakens the beged because it looks nicer. The weakening of the beged is not significant because he doesn't wear it so often. And that's the difference between them. Others suggest that the difference here might be between a glima, which is made out of linen, versus a sarvala that is made out of wool. And it might be that the size of the strings are different. That is, by the glima, which is made out of linen, over there we would say that the warp strings are thicker. Whereas by the sarvala, which is made out of tzemer, there we say that the woof strings are thicker. Never would make a difference which way you comb it, because you want to comb along the thicker strings. We said before, you can't put in more than three loops. So here, the Gemara's question seems to favor Rashi's explanation, which is by Rabbi Yirmiya. This is a question that comes up. Gemara here in Nidah and Menachot brings it up, but it also comes up with regards to Lulav, meaning Yana Diyoma. Is that when you shake the Lulav, Yerushalmi asks this question, the Gemara in Sukkah, and Bavli has something along those lines as well, which is that when you shake the Lulav, it says you have to shake it Gimel Pe'amim. You have to shake it three times. What does it mean to shake your lulav three times? Does that mean when you go push it out, that's one? You pull it back in, that's two? Push it out again, that's three. So now you've done three na'anu'im with the lulav. Or does three mean out, in? That's one na'anu'ah. Out, in. You have to do that, repeat that three times in order to have the three na'anu'im. The same question is being asked over here, which is, am tuye va tuye chad. According to Rashi here, where the loop can only made three ply, you can have it stitch it three times. What does it mean that you put in a stitch? Is a stitch you go in and then pull it back? That's called one. Or if you put it in and pull it back, that's already two. How many times do you count it? So that's what the Gemara asks over here. Amtuye v'atuye chad. In and out is one stitch. Odilma amtuye v'atuye trei. Or it's in one, out is two. And the stitch, then you only go one more time in. So that's the question here about these three. Teiku. The Gemara leaves this as an unresolved issue. And that's what we do by lulav. We're choshesh for the fact that in and out is only considered to be one. And therefore, when we're menaneh the lulav, we go in and out three times in each direction in order to accomplish the nanuim. Okay, umeshviul the arko, he can cut it when he wants to even it out. He does it along the length of a lola rachbo, but not along the width. Vatanya ipcho, we have a bright that says just the opposite. Lokashab glima habahem yune. It's a difference between a tunic and a belt or a girdle. The difference being that when you wear a glima, then you wear it for its length. It goes across along the whole body of the individual. It's a tunic that goes from their neck all the way down to their ankles. Therefore, you want to even it out or slice it along the lengthwise to make it properly fit lengthwise. On the other hand, when it comes to the belt, the only thing that is visible of the belt is the end of the belt. Think of a gartel that you tie around and then the edges of the gartel of the belt are hanging over. Those are the only parts. That's the rochav, that's the width of the belt. The length of the belt is already around the back or inside the tunic. It's just the front, the tie part that sticks out. That's the rochav. So that's the part you want to even out because that's the part that is visible. Tarabanan. Ein lochim na sorek muchin, mipnei she'enu shalom. As opposed to what we said before in the Braita, that when you go to a koveis, you can buy the tufts of wool or the shreds of wool because he's entitled to keep them. The sorek who's not entitled to keep them, then you can't buy them from him because it looks like he stole them and he's trying to sell them to you. And a place where the minag is that it belongs to him, then you can buy it. So again, that's what I said before. A lot of these have to do with mores of society. The rules or the social contract that is between people about how they conduct themselves in these situations. The minag is that the sarek keeps them, then you can buy from them and also he's entitled to keep them. In any location, you can buy it from them, a mattress or a comforter full of stuffing, as well as a pillow full of stuffing. Meaning these are wool remnant stuffings that they're putting in there. My taima. What's the reason? Meaning that if he's stealing these shreds of wool, or he's stealing these tufts of wool, and then he just puts a lot of them into a mattress or into a pillow, why are you allowed to keep it? The answer is, kanininu b'shinui. He acquired them through the shinui. Even if he is a gazlan and he stole them, he changed them now from wool into stuffing. And now they changed it from wool to stuffing, there's a shinui. So you have a gzela and a shinui. So when you buy it from him, you're no longer interacting with the property that's gazla. It now belongs to him because he stole it in a manner that now makes it his. Is that why you have permission to do it? Tarabanan. Ein lochim migardi. You cannot buy from a weaver. Lo irin. You can't buy irin. Now, as Rashi describes over here, the irin are pieces of wool that are put on the edges, Rashi claims over here, of the kanei hasheti, you know, that they're put on the bars that hold the warp strings. The warp strings are rolled onto a bar, and as you work through the weaving, you're pulling, that you spin or turn that bar, and that releases the warp strings. So in order to hold them in place, at the edges, so the strings don't unwind or move freely off of the rod, you put pieces of wool at the edges. It could also be on the shuttle, when you're using the woof, and you're throwing the shuttle through the strings. In order to hold the wool on the shuttle, they use these irin. You can see that here in the picture that I have here, that there's a little tuft of wool here at the edge that holds, stops the string from unwinding or rolling off the edge there. That little white over there. It would be the same thing if he did it on the rod here that holds the warp, that he put it on the edge here to stop it from unwinding when it's turning, that it doesn't slide off and it stays positioned the way that you want it. So those are the irin. The next thing you're not allowed to buy from him is the nirin, which are, according to Rashi, those are the heddles. Those are the loops through which they pass the strings of the warp. Meaning that they used to have them go through these loops, and then they move up and down so that you can throw the shuttle through, and then switch with strings on top and which is on the bottom. So those heddles, those loops that are made, they're made out of the wool. Those you can't buy from him as well. Velo punkalin. And you also can't buy from him the punkalin. Punkalin are either the remnants of the woof threads, or they are possibly, according to Rashi, they are a standing weaving machine rather than a sitting weaving machine. I mean, it's a different mechanism for doing the weaving, and the punkalin are the equivalent of the nirin that you find by the sitting weaving machine rather than the standing weaving machine. Velo shayurei pakiyot, and you can't take the remnants of the coils. Now, if you think that this means the remnants of the coils and the pakiyot and the punkalin could be the bobbins upon which the string is tied around or stuck around when they spin it, meaning that the bobbin, you still have it on the modern day sewing machine, the bobbin is where you place the thread on the top and it unwinds from there. So this would mean that the leftovers on the coils or the bobbins, one for the warp, one for the woof, then the remnants that are left when you finally unwound the whole thing, you don't get to keep those. All of those you can't buy from them because they all belong to the balabait, to the one who gave him the wool to work with, and therefore you can't buy any of those from him. Avalokimem beged minumar, you can buy from them a beged that is spotted. What that implies is that he basically took a bunch of remnants and he put them together and he made it into a beged. What you assume here is that he actually stole what he wasn't supposed to steal and he put them together. Why are you allowed to do that? For the same reason Rashi says as above, which is kaninu bishinui. He's konedem bishinui. I think the Ravid asks on this explanation, aren't these shinuim achuzer lebriyatan? These are all changes that can be reversed and taken back to their original state. That's not a strong enough shinoi to make a kinyan. The answer is that over here, we're not certain that he stole it. There's circumstantial evidence that he stole it. Because there's only circumstantial evidence, any type of shinoi would be enough for us to say you can buy it from him now, because that gives us another reason to buy it from him. So even though maybe it's not significant shinoi in other contexts, over here it's significantly significant that we would allow you to buy it from him in this instance. Erev visheti, you can buy from him strings of the woof or strings of the warp. Tavoi, strings that are spun. Ve'arig, and strings that are woven. The Gemara asks over here, Amre, hashta tavoi shakli. If you can buy from him spun strings, arug mi baye, then you have to tell me about woven things. Items that are woven, the strings have to be spun before you can weave them. So if that's the case, it's a prerequisite for weaving. You tell me you can buy from him the spun strings, you of course can buy from him the woven strings. My arig. So then what is the arig over here? TK. TK are plates. P-L-A-I-T-S. Or they are strings that are twisted but not spun. So it's a way to create the string without it actually being spun. It's a way to create a thread of some sort that is not as strong or as utilitarian as a spun string, but it still can be utilized in order to make either plates or to use these twisted strings in the creation of the woven beged. So it's a weaving that does not include spinning in the process of the weaving. Now, in all these cases, Rashi again claims that if the item is significantly changed, that there's a shinui here, and that generates the kinyan. I'll just add in what I mentioned yesterday as well, is once you have a significant input or effort by the individual placed into the item, we believe that it's less likely that he stole it. Because if he's working with merchandise that's stolen, he's always at risk that he's going to get caught. If he's at risk that he's going to get caught, there's less chance that he's going to risk getting caught and losing all his effort or money that he invested into the item. And therefore, in these situations where he's invested a lot in the item, it's less likely that he stole the item because he's working with stolen merchandise. It's too risky for him to invest that much in the item. So that would be another mitigating factor to assume why here it's probably not stolen goods. All right. And Tanu Rabbanan, Ein lo chimen atzaba, from a dyer you may not purchase, lo otot, testers, as Rashi says, they were testing the colors, they tried a tester of the color, lo dugmaot, and not samples of the color that he's supposed to do. Because both of those are given to him by the balabait. The balabait gives him the wool, and then he puts a tester in. That's the balabait's wool that he used for the tester. The sample is given to him by the balabait to see what color he's supposed to make. Since they belong to the balabait, he has to return them to the balabait. They're not for him to keep. And not the little shreds of wool that come away. He's not allowed to keep them. Avalokimem beged savua. What you can buy from them is a large dyed beged. Tavoy, something that is spun. Or bigadim. In general, bigadim. Hashta tavoy shakil. It says over here that you're allowed to buy from them spun items. Bigadim ibai. Then you have to tell me they can buy clothing. Again, a prerequisite for clothing to be woven is that it's spun beforehand. My bigadim namte. Bigadim over here is felt. Felt does not require. Felt is pressed rather than spun, and therefore it doesn't require spinning. And you could have a beged that's made out of felt that never was spun, or the wool there was never spun. So you have instances where a beged would not go through that processing of the spinning. All right, so now, based on that, you can buy from him items that, again, are more significant, either because it's a shinoi, and he's koneh through the shinoi, or it's too big an item that he wouldn't have stolen it, it's too obvious that he stole it. Or number three, what I said, it's too big an investment by him in the item that if he stole it, he would not invest in this way. He would try to sell it off as fast as possible in the state that he got it in so that he doesn't lose if he gets caught with the item. All right. Tan Rabbanan. Anoteno wrote Abdan, person who gives over hides to the tanner to work. Kitsuim vatlushim are elu shel balabait. When he cuts off, he straightens out the edges of the hides or the hairs that come off of the hides that all belongs to the balabait. Ba'ole umishatef mamayim, the stuff that floats to the surface when he washes the hide, harielu shelo, those belong to the tanner. So the items that are the slicing off of the skins to straighten them out, those little shreds that come away, as well as the hair that comes away from the hide, that all belongs to the original owner. That which floats to the top in the washing process, the balabait is not makpid on, is mochel on that, and therefore the tanner can keep those items. Imaya shachor. So on the Mishnah, that if it was black, you can pull it out, v'chule. Amar Rabbi Yehuda, katsra shemei. In Aramaic, a launderer is called a katsra. V'katsra shakile. And he says it's a play on words. The reason he's called a launderer is a katsra is because he's kotser the beged. He shortens the beged because he pulls out strings. Every time we discuss this, he pulls out the strings and he shortens the beged. Amar Rabbi Yehuda, akol olim the minyan tchelet. Everything counts towards the minyan tchelet. When it comes to putting in tzitzit in a beged, that's what tchelet means over here, there is a minimum requirement when it comes to putting the string tied on the corner of the beged. It must be at least in a godel away from the edge. It has to be a thumb's length away from the edge. And it cannot be more than three etzba'ot away from the edge. What is considered to be the edge of the beged? That's what Rabbi Yehuda says over here, that the extra three strings that are put in the beged, they count towards the amount. Meaning that if you mention the agoldo, the shlosh etzbaot, they count towards it. But he says, my son Yitzchak is makpid on them. Now either it can mean that he's makpid to take those strings out, therefore they don't count towards the agoldo, the shlosh etzbaot, or it means that he's makpid because he doesn't know what the aloch is. He's uncertain as to whether they count or don't count towards the beged. Therefore, he takes them out to be on the safe side so he doesn't have to make that decision. Hachayat shishier et achut. A tailor that leaves over a string or the leftover string, can he keep it? V'kama litfor. How much does it mean that you need string left over that would be good for stitching? Amravasi melo machat chutz lamachat. It's mo machat and something more beyond the machat. So it's enough that it's a needle's worth plus some more. Ibayelu. Now that's some more. What does it mean? Malay machat v'chutz the machat k'mlo machat. Is it mean that you have a mlo machat, you have a needle's worth, plus the excess is another needle's worth? Odilma mlo machat v'chutz the machat mashu. Or maybe it means a needle's worth plus a little more in excess of that. Tashma, d'tanya. If he has leftover string or thread that is less than the amount to stitch with, or a patch that is less than 3x3 at Zbo'ot, again, it's like what our Mishnah said, the Balabait is makpid on those items, they belong to him, he gets to take them. If the Balabait is not makpid on them, they belong to the worker here or to the tailor. If you say over here, it means a full needle's worth plus an additional needle's worth, that means that excess. Then if it's less than that, why would the tailor want that thread? Again, if it is a needle's worth plus another needle's worth, I know why you want to keep it, because it's useful now to stitch with it. That's why the balabayit wants it. If it's less than that, we said that the tailor can keep it. Why would the tailor want to keep a string or a thread that is useless? So here, if it is a melo machat plus another melo machat, then the string a little bit below that is useful for a sichta, which is making of a loop. It might have to do with what we said above with regards to the heddle loops. That might be what you can use it for. You can use it as a near. You can use it for the heddle. That might be what the sichta is over here. Or the other possibility, Rashi says, it's the chavin. It's the loops that they used up above to tie the baget to stretch it out. You can use it for one of those loops to tie out the baget. So it's useful for that. If you think he means a needle's worth plus it's just a little more, what can you utilize it for? If it's only a needle's worth, you can't even stitch it because you pull it through and it comes out the other side. There's nothing left to hold it on. Must mean when he said that you have to have that amount of string, the balabait is makbid less than he's not, is mlo machat, v'chutz l'machat, k'mlo machat. Has to be a needle's worth plus an additional needle's worth in order for the balabait to be makbid and want to keep it. Otherwise, it belongs to the tailor, shmaminah. That is the explanation over here. All right, Masha Harash, we spoke about the carpenter in the Mishnah. V'rminu, Masha Harash motzi b'mitza'ad. That which the Harash, the carpenter, takes off with an adz or a plane, va'nifsak b'migeira, and that which comes off with a saw, harielu shel balabayit. They belong to the balabayit. That's a stira to our Mishnah. Our Mishnah said that which was taken off with the adz or the plane belongs to the carpenter. Over here it says it belongs to the balabayit. Yotzei mitachat makdeach, that which comes out from a bore or a drill, omitachat behitni, or below a plane, as Rashi says that others translate as a chisel, vanigrar bimigeira, and that which is not sliced off with the saw, but rather that which is moved by the saw, like the sawdust, that are elu shalo, that belongs to the carpenter. Amarava, so now we have a stira between our Mishnah and the Braita as to what the story with a matzad is. Is the matzad belong to the carpenter? That's what our Mishnah says. Or does the matzad belong to the balabayit? That's what the Braita says. Amarava, ba'ashu, the Tana Didan, in the city of the author of our Mishnah, ikatarte chatzine. They have two different types of planing mechanisms. L'rabati, the bigger one, karile kashil. They call it kashil, or the way we translate it in the Mishnah was an X. L'zutrati, the smaller one, karila matzad. They call that a plane or a adz. Ba'ach of the Tana Bara, in the city of the author of the Braita, chadhu de'ika. They only have one planing mechanism, and karila matzad, and they call it a matzad. So it's not the same matzad that we're speaking about in the Mishnah. The matzad in the Mishnah is a smaller utensil, therefore it gives smaller strips, and that's why the carpenter can keep it. The matzad that is being mentioned in the Braita is the equivalent of an axe, and it gives larger strips on it, and that's why it belongs to the balabayit. V'imaya ose etzel balabayit v'chulei, tan rabbanan, misatetei avanim, those that are chiselers of the stone workers, stone cutters, eimbeh mishum gezel. They can keep the residual or the chips that come away from the chiseling of the stone. It sounds like here that we're talking about regular stones. We're not talking about precious stones over here. We're talking about what they use for buildings. In the absence of a minog, you would assume if it's something that's significant or precious, the balabayit keeps it. Otherwise, it goes to the worker. If there's a minog medina, if there's a normal trade practice, then that governs in the situation because everybody practices that way, irrespective of what the values are. Mefaske ilanot, those that prune or thin out the trees. Mefaske gifanim, those that prune or thin out the vines of the vineyard. Menachfei hege, those that trim the shrubs or the bushes. Menachshei zraim, those that weed out the plants. Ve'odrei yirakot, and those that thin out the vegetables. Over here using odair is like a hoe, but they hoe out the vegetables in between to give more space for the other vegetables. Anytime the balabayit is makpid to keep those that he took out, those that he pruned off, yesh ben mishum gezel, then the worker may not keep them, and there's gezel to keep them. Ain balabait makpid alayim. If the balabait's not makpid on such an item, harielu shelo. Then the worker can keep them because the balabait doesn't care about those excesses. He's after what's left behind. The stronger tree, the stronger vines, the vegetables that are left in the ground. That's what he's after. The stuff that's taken out, he's not interested in, and therefore the worker can keep them. Again, that's what we said here. It has to do with the mentality of the balabait as to what the decision should be about who it belongs to. Again, absent a minag medina. I'm Rabbi Yehuda. Kashult v'chaziz. Hops. And the way Rashi describes it over here, this chaziz is like unripe fodder. It's animal feed, but it's animal feed before it becomes straw, while it's still in its like green shoot stage. Ein b'hem mishum gezel. They don't have a din of gezel because people aren't makpid on these types of things. Ba'atra de kapte, yesh b'hem mishum gezel. In a place where they are makpid on this, then there is a din of gezel. So here is what we said before, that there is a minag medina might dictate. So even though over here, people are generally not makpid on these things, they're not expensive or valuable enough to be makpid, nevertheless, in cities where they are makpid on it, then it is gezel because the minag medina dictates. Amaravina, umatamachsia atra de kaptehu. Matamachsia is a city or a place that is makpid on these items, and therefore the workers are not entitled to keep them, or people aren't entitled to keep them, you have to give them to the balabait. Okay, with that we complete Masechet Baba Kama. Hadron alach, agozel batra, slik alach, Masechet Baba Kama.